It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 482. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. This show is brought to you in part by Instant House Call. Remotely support your customers unattended and on demand through firewalls. Try it free by clicking the link on my website at miketechshow.com. Use the promo code MikeTechShow. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics at miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. And that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow. Facebook, you can like the Mike Tech Show page, and that on Facebook is Mike Nation Net. Check out the wiki. That's at mtswiki.com, and you'll find links to all the past shows, the audio, all the show notes going back to show one. I have a great show lined up tonight, and as I promised, I'm going to catch up on all of your email. But first, there's an important email I want to get to, and we'll call this Crypto Locker Part 2. Last week, I dedicated the show to Crypto Locker, and I mentioned the utility Crypto Prevent by Foolish IT. His name is Nick. Nick listened to the show, listened to my comments about the utility in Crypto Locker, and wrote me this email. And then I followed up and I asked him for permission to read this on the air, and he said yes. So here we go. Mike, first, let me say thank you for mentioning Crypto Prevent on your last show, but I feel that you misrepresented its capabilities and usefulness to your listeners. Please allow me to explain more about the prevention methodology used by Crypto Prevent. Specifically, you mentioned that it only blocks executables in percent app data percent and temporary extracted executables. This is incorrect. The primary location-based rules that Crypto Prevent implements are designed to block executables in percent app data percent and any first-level subdirectories, no matter what they are named. The local app data directory, the start menu program's startup folder, not .lnk files, just executables. The user profile, all user profiles, program data, and nested subdirectories inside the recycle bin. All favorite hiding places of malware, but that is not where the protection stops. In fact, Crypto Prevent can create over 200 policy rules designed to block this and many other types of malware, and not all these rules are location-based. I agree with you that malware authors can and eventually will change the locations where it installs to, possibly even using system root / system 32, and that cannot be blocked realistically, even with whitelisting capabilities. This is why Crypto Prevent also adds protection against fake file extensions. Example, invoice.pdf.exe in any location. And I believe that this will continue to protect most end users despite malware location changes. When designing this feature, I consulted a security researcher at sanesecurity.com, a maker of third-party definitions for ClamAV, to determine the most common extension types in use. After examining over 400 samples of current Trojan-based malware in the wild, it was determined that executables with fake file extensions are the primary infection method of this and the majority of other Trojan-based malware when distributed via email, relying on tricking users who have file extensions hidden, the default setting in Windows, or users who do not otherwise know what a file extension is and means, even if they are visible. Specifically, Crypto Prevents Fake File Extension Protection blocks, and he has a very large list here, PDF, Doc, DocX, XLS, XLSX, PPT, PPTX, TXT, RTF, ZIP, RAR, 7Z, JPEG, JPG, PNG, GIF, AVI, MPG, WMA, WMV, WAV, DivX, MP4, EXE, COM, SCR, and PIF. Again, that isn't all. Even if you educated all of your users about file extensions and disabled the hidden file extensions setting, users can still be tricked into executing a Trojan dropper when the malware utilizes RLO, and that's right-to-left override, exploits, which can fool even an experienced user with file extensions being visible. Granted, this tactic is not yet utilized by CryptoLocker. It may be in the future, and it is a solid tactic successfully used by some other Trojan-based malware. So Crypto Prevent implements a policy to block all executable anywhere in the file system with the RLO character embedded in the file name. To quote, you said something to the effect of, nothing can stop a human being from opening an email attachment. I agree completely, though I believe that if you can block the malicious executable code, that attachment, then you've successfully prevented the infection and saved your users time and lost productivity and quite possibly their data as well. I fully admit that Crypto Prevent does not mean the end of Trojan-based infections, and it's not the only defense one should utilize. User education, implementing good antivirus and email filtering, a good backup system, etc. However, I feel that Crypto Prevent goes a very long way towards stopping not only current variants of the CryptoLocker malware, which will continue to float around for some time to come, even after new variants are released, but quite possibly it may also stop future variants, and it will definitely stop a lot of other Trojan-based malware as well. My intention is not to provide users with a false sense of security, but rather to provide an additional layer of defense against this and other threats. I fully intend to continue studying the infection methods and this and other malware and continue to improve the application where possible as malware authors change their tactics. While I realize I cannot compensate for every change that they may make in the future, I staunchly believe in doing all that I can to help as many users as possible right now. To me, this also means listening to others in the industry and accepting feedback on the program. If you have anything to provide, I'll be happy to listen and implement whatever I can. Thanks for your time, Nick, aka Foolish IT. I wrote Nick and thanked him for taking the time to explain in such great detail his program and his methodology and how he's approaching development of Crypto Prevent. The first link in tonight's show notes is a link to his Crypto Prevent Premium. It's free. You can download it, but he asked for a nominal $15 and it will automatically update. Now, you can manually update it, but if you want to support his efforts, I recommend that. I am installing the free version of Crypto Prevent on every one of my client systems as just another layer of security. Now, remember, this is not a program that is actively running. It is a program that you run that changes the security policy on the local machine. So it's not like we're taking up CPU cycles here. We have nothing to lose. And I really like the whitelist option that he has, because let's say in that rare circumstance, you do have a program that has to execute out of one of the directories that it's stopped. You can whitelist that program. I think it's worth it. But remember, the point of last week's show was not to diss this. I said, I think it's great what he's done. I don't want anybody thinking that just because you install this, as Nick agrees, this is not in lieu of running a good antivirus software, running a Malwarebytes Pro, running Root to help you in blocking those bad websites and going there. And of course, the most important thing, backing up. So remember, in a layered approach to security, we want Crypto Prevent antivirus software. I'm going to have a link. I have been playing with ESET Nod on three systems here, and I'm giving that a thumbs up. I've now been playing with it for over a month. I'm going to have a link, and yes, it's my Amazon link, but guess what ESET Nod costs for three licenses, for three PCs? $24. So we're not talking a lot of money here. We're only talking $8. So ESET Nod, or at least Avast or Sophos, some of these antivirus programs that we've been getting lots of great recommendations for. Malwarebytes Pro, I think everybody agrees that that's a great program to help prevent malware. Woot, Web of Trust, it's free. Add it to every browser that you have. Go one step further. Add OpenDNS to protect phishing and to protect the sites that you go to. And implement a good backup program. And you know what? You're safe. You have good backups. You've done everything that you can to prevent. It's not 100%. Something can get through, but we've just really minimized it. And we're going to make it, if everybody does this, you know what? We're going to see less and less of these crypto locker infections, because they're not going to be able to make any money. There's nobody left to infect. So this is what we want to preach. This is what we want to make sure encompasses this layered security approach. And I thank Nick for doing such a tremendous job for all the users and the entire community by providing such a great utility that changes the local policies and helps prevent the infections. All right, let's get to a large stack of email. I want to catch up. This is from Terry, and it's in response to last week's show where I recommended, you know, McAfee for filtering your email. Guess what? I have a client that was infected with CryptoLocker and has the McAfee mail filter scanning system. It will not catch it. Right now, I'm recommending all inbound messages with attachments be quarantined for my clients. How about that? How about that? It got through a professional cloud-based mail scanner like McAfee. That's not a bad idea. But how can you block all attachments for a business? That's why you implement everything that I just said earlier in the show. Hi, Mike. Great show on CryptoLocker. It's too bad that something like this must happen for a business to start doing backup and security best practices. Like you found, if you do backup best practices, CryptoLocker is an annoyance. I have been a security professional in the Delaware Valley since 2000. We use Shadow Protect and MX Logic, and like you, can highly recommend them. One thing that you did not mention is the use of a unified threat management device. I use Fortinet, but a Sonic Wall WatchGuard, or similar. UTMs allow you to block files and attachments on HTTP, HTTPS, FTP, and SMTP. My recommendation is block executables at the gateway. The list I use is at the bottom of the email, and he has a long list. For example, if you block EXEs, CryptoLocker cannot get into your network. UTMs are smart enough to block EXEs that are zipped up. I block executables for the web, FTP, and email. If we block all executables, you might be wondering, how do we get updates from Microsoft, Adobe, and Sun? We simply create an allow list of the websites I trust for executables. Adding a properly configured UTM will greatly reduce your attack surface. It's not 100% protection, but it is light years ahead of what most SMBs are doing today. You may have to use content filtering in the past and turned it off because the one time the president of the company needed to get to a website or download a critical file and they could not get it in a timely fashion. I have solved that problem for my clients. If a customer gets blocked, they are approved to override the block. They can send an email to my NOC requesting the URL to be unblocked. My automated NOC tool will allow the URL for the customer and reply within 2 minutes. So you can have a high level of security while giving the client the power to get business done. Thanks, Troy. Troy, excellent idea. Tremendous responses from everybody, and I so appreciate this, and that's why I couldn't wait to share these solutions. This is from Jesse. I may be late to the party on this one as I downloaded your podcasts and don't listen to them as timely as I would like sometimes. Here are my comments on your antivirus recommendations for home users and servers. We have used Avest Free as our main antivirus along with Malwarebytes Pro. We have this on probably 100 machines over the last 9 months and have had very few problems with virus or on our overall operations. The only downside is that you do have to register it with an email address for a 1-year protection. Avast doesn't pester the customer with a bunch of garbage like AVG does. I also have used GFI Max. This is another recommendation for GFI Max. And it seems to work pretty well. The only downside is that removing the managed antivirus is kind of cumbersome and not very immediate. I have one client who I have Avast on their server and it has run with no problem. To install endpoint protection, you need to purchase a minimum of 5 licenses. Therefore, with the client, I have it on 4 workstations and the server. It retails for $175, and I think I get about a 20% margin on it. They do have a central console also per customer. They also offer nonprofit discounts as well that I believe are about 50% off. I have a Avast endpoint installed at our church for a pretty good rate since most of the free ones aren't licensed for nonprofits or business workstations. Another good question is what is the best antivirus to use for a business workstation without a server? Avast is kind of expensive for regular business with no server. I'm a little stumped on this one. Other than maybe Security Essentials along with Malwarebytes Pro, which requires a business license at $24.95 per year instead of a lifetime license. Thanks. Great shows as always. Right now, I'm kind of leaning to ESET Nod for workstations where we need a more robust antivirus client on a workstation. This is in response to a few weeks ago, I mentioned that DNS hell I went through with a client, and I mentioned about the TTL, which is time to live. Just a small note from listening to show 479. I think you said you changed the TTL at the same time you changed the A record, but really, You need to make this change 24 to 48 hours before changing the A record. This is because the old IP will have been given out to requests with the current TTL, say 24 hours. This means that those servers will probably not check back again for the new IP until the TTL expires. So changing the TTL when you change the A record is too late. Already some DNS servers will know the old address and will not be checking back. Great show, by the way. Listen to you, Todd, and Leo all the time. Cheers. And this is from Matt. He's absolutely correct. I was actually lucky. The TTL was only set at an hour, so that wasn't too bad. And I went from an hour to a half hour. But he's absolutely right. If you're going to make an important A record change in your DNS, make sure you go in 48 hours in advance and lower the TTL, the time to live, make that an hour or a half hour, and let that propagate over the 48 hours. Then make your A record change, and it's going to be updated within that time. This is from Mark, and Mark is responding to the Mac upgrade to Mavericks and Windows 8.1. Hi, Mike, Mavericks. My upgrade to Mavericks went pretty smoothly. I noticed one of the Gmail issues you mentioned. Looks like Mavericks changed how they are handling IMAP. But I don't hide the all mail label, so it's not an issue. So far, I only experienced one upgrade issue. There is a pending iMovie upgrade in the Mac App Store application. It will not apply to my older late 2007 iMac, telling me it's not compatible with my graphics card. So there sits in the upgrade queue. That must be the end of the line for iMovie improvements on this machine, and I will probably have to look at the red upgrade badge on my dock forever. Since he's written this, Apple has released a patch to fix the mail problem with Mavericks in communicating with Gmail. All those issues, they seem to have been fixed. Now, this is his comments on Windows 8.1. I don't know why they moved the upgrade into the App Store, except now they tricked you into registering your copy of Windows. Most people ignore registering on activation. After several tries and changing absolutely nothing, it finally downloaded. While my machine is an old Atom 1.G processor with SSD and probably much slower than yours, cold boot to log in from Windows 8 is 26 seconds. Cold boot to log in from Windows 8.1 is 15 seconds. I can't explain this. I did make sure it was finished setting everything up. Note, I did not choose to set up the cloud features. Other than supplying my ID, I skipped the setup. Could it be the cloud component? Or did you configure that in Windows 8 also? No, I didn't. And you know what, Mark? I got to look into that. Mark, thank you. And you've given me something to look at, because one of my biggest complaints of going to Windows 8.1 is it's slower to boot. What's going on? I was so happy with my 10-second boot in Windows 8. And to go from 10 seconds to 25 seconds, you're thinking, Mike, you know, you're pretty picky here. 15 seconds? That's a lifetime when you're sitting there waiting and you were used to, you know, I was used to 10 seconds and I'm in. Now I got to wait 25 seconds? I'm going to look to see. There's got to be something activated that was not activated on 8, but now is there for 8.1. Windows 8.1 recovery. This is from Terry. Mike, I have an Asus S4000CA VioBook. I upgraded to Windows 8.1 from Windows 8. Without a problem. I used the wbadmin command to create a system image on an external USB hard drive. I created a Windows 8.1 recovery USB. I even booted from the recovery USB and verified that it could see my system image. On my Asus Ultrabook, there is not a window sticker on it with a product key. I used Keyfinder to obtain my key and saved it on SkyDrive just in case I needed it. That's some very good advice. My question is, if a customer or family member has a fatal hard drive crash and there's no recovery media and no product key, how do you legally reinstall Windows 8? I mean, without having to buy a copy of Windows 8. I'm shocked that there's no key anywhere for a retail system. There's got to be. There's got to be evidence of a product key somewhere when you buy the new hardware. I have been in this situation with someone with Windows 7. I was able to download a Windows 7 ISO and then use the key on the window sticker. Yes, absolutely. Always look forward to listening to your podcast. Thanks for what you do, Terry. Hey, if anybody's got some advice there, that's kind of difficult. You know, if you don't have any reference of a key anywhere on the physical hardware and the drive totally crashes, that's a problem. I would say you end up taking the box back to where you bought it or calling them and saying, look, do you have a record of my purchase of this machine? Do you have a record of the product key for the version of Windows that you supplied me with the system? I would have to think that the place of purchase is going to have some kind of a record of that, I would hope. This is from Ronnie. Again, Windows 8.1. Hey, Mike. Been listening for a couple of months now and love the show. I really have to disagree with you on Windows 8.1. I am loving this thing. My laptop boots up in about 6.5 seconds. See, life is not fair. I'm running on a $250 Toshiba satellite that I got on sale. It features a third-gen i3 processor and 6 gigs of RAM. My processor's i7, and I have 8 gigs of RAM, and I have a fast SSD drive. I threw in an Intel 3 Series SSD, and the thing is screaming. Also, they did sort of bring back the start button. Yeah, but not really. It's a half a start button at best. If you right-click on the Windows icon, yes, I know. But I install Classic Shell either way. See? Yeah. I have to say, overall, though, I'm extremely, extremely satisfied with Windows 8.1. Thanks. This is from Ronnie. Ronnie, thank you. And I will always share every side. So there are some happy people with Windows 8.1. I just don't happen to be one of them. This next email is from John. I have a comment on Windows 8. I have tested Windows 8 and 8.1 in a VirtualBox for the past year, and there's one issue I see with Metro. Well, 8.1 hasn't been out that long. It is the inability to have two or more monitors with three or four or more programs displayed at the same time. In my line of work, I usually have an ERP program like SAP running. Also, I have several CAD files open in AutoCAD, MathCAD, and several other engineering-specific programs running. Several PDF files may also be open. At the same time, I may be searching the internet product information from a pump vendor. Finally, I am using instant message to request data from a coworker. In many respects, Metro is like the command line days. You could use only one program at a time, and you use a terminate and stay resident function to switch problems. It appears Microsoft may be pushing one monitor and one application open at a time for workflow. Several recent articles at Windows Supersite are proclaiming the desktop is dead. Also, business consultant recently told me they were recommending to clients a one-monitor, one-program computing policy. That's crazy. They were against having a multiple programs open on work PC. Could it be Microsoft is to say we know what's good for business computing? And what good is one monitor for an app running? What do you think? Well, first off, I wouldn't be judging Metro for the engineering apps that you're trying to run. I would never even consider that. If you want to be running in the regular native Windows desktop for all your programs, and Windows 8 supports multiple monitors better than any operating system prior to that. So as much as I bash Windows 8.1, it does support multi-monitors. So I don't understand where you're coming from. If it's just from a Metro standpoint, well, all right, let's not use Metro. I don't agree with the Metro interface for Windows Desktop. I do not believe the Windows Desktop is dead. Absolutely not. There are too many, well, what am I saying? Too many business. Every business, you have to compile Word documents. Look, you're running CAD and engineering software. You're not going to run that from a tablet. You're not going to run that from a netbook. The desktop is not dead. I would disagree with all those pundits that are spewing that. I don't think that's true. And the clients I'm running into, they're lining up looking for new desktops now that they want to purchase that's running Windows 7 or Windows 8 to upgrade from Windows XP. Great. I'm helping clients right now. I'm speccing out more Dell Optiplexes than I've ever done in the past. The desktop is not dead. Far from it. This is from Tim. Hi, Mike. In the last show, you said right in about any Windows 8.1 issues, so I thought I'd share a few that I've ran into so far. First off, my HP laptop will not update to 8.1. I have tried 3 times now with no avail. Upon restart, after downloading, it simply states that it could not update to Windows 8.1 and that it will revert back to 8. I have had no such issues with my desktop PC, which is home built. I have come into a few other issues after the update, though. After the update, I noticed that my SteelSeries gaming mouse engine had gone. The engine is to change CPI settings and such. When I tried to re-download it from SteelSeries website, there was a warning not to, as it caused a fatal error in Windows 8.1. Upon further research, I learned that it was to do with the mouse driver getting caught in a loop on install, thus preventing Windows 8.1 from booting. In a sense, I was pretty lucky with this, as I had no such issue when updating to 8.1. But I have just been left with no mouse engine. SteelSeries said they are working on a solution and should have a fix around the 10th of November. I also had an issue with a utility called EVGA Precision X. This is a utility for tuning and overclocking EVGA branded video cards. There is a feature on it that I use called frame rate target, which basically caps the frame rate. With this feature turned on, my games either crash on startup or I get a horrible tearing on the screen when playing them, regardless of whatever VSync is enabled or not. I am currently looking into another piece of software and also waiting for a possible update and fix. Another issue I ran into is updating to Windows 8.1 was that all my games were now in 3D. Don't laugh. I fixed this by disabling the enable stereoscopic 3D option in my NVIDIA control panel. Finally, the last issue I ran into was that EA's FIFA 13 game from the Origin client would no longer start. The solution I found was to disable Windows Error Report, not something I was terribly eager to buy in, as it never has been much of assistance anyway. Anyway, just wanted to share those few things with the community and hope there can be some assistance to anybody experience similar issues. Kind regards. This is Tim from Cornwall, England. Tim, thanks for checking in and writing this. So it seems like there could be specific gaming issues with Windows 8.1. I am not a gamer, so I would never run into that. So I'm glad to share that with everybody. And if you are a gamer and you're considering upgrading to 8.1, you better read forums and check the game manufacturers and all of your hardware devices, like specific gaming keyboards, mice, your graphics card, and make sure that it is properly supported under Windows 8.1 before you do that upgrade. This is from Paul. and he has another Android podcast player. Hi, listening to your last podcast, I tried the recommendation. This one I think is better, and it's free, and it does have some advertisements. It's the IPP podcast player. For me, it has the advantage of getting its feeds from iTunes, and I do not have an iTunes account. It can play back via Bluetooth and be able to install to my SD card. If you get an Android device, check it out. And that's IPP Podcast Player. Thank you, Paul. This is from Arnold. Support contracts. Have you ever explained in detail how you sell your support contracts? Absolutely. I've actually did a show in the past. I know I did. What it includes, what it doesn't include, and how you pitch it. I have been listening for a breakdown over your shows and either missed it or you've never broke it down. Also, I have a product recommendation, OneMesh.com, a great inexpensive access point solution with cloud-based functionality. Thank you, this is Arnie. Arnie, I appreciate it. For contracts, it's simple. I have a standard contract that I plug in the information for scope of work. And that's the blood and guts of a support contract. And it's going to vary from client to client. Before I recommend a contract, I sit down and I have a detailed conversation and I understand the client's needs. What are they looking for? Are they a light touch, heavy touch? Do they just want an hour or two a month? Are they looking for full blown, maybe 10 or 15 hours a month? What are they looking for? I always inquire how many hours, if they had a previous IT support contract or another vendor was helping them, how many hours over the year did they use? Because I want to align it as best I can with, and that's the tough part, trying to get a feel for that. If they have a server, I recommend weekly or bi-weekly analysis of their event logs, any of the logs that's on the system, hardware, software, constantly monitoring their backup. I recommend quarterly workstation updates where you clean, make sure the antivirus is updated, any malware is doing its proper updates, making sure Adobe Flash and Java and all that stuff's updated, making sure you've run all of your junkware removal tools and you're cleaning it up in your CCleaner. That should be done quarterly on every workstation. So you just do the math, you add it up, and you pitch the client that this is preventative maintenance so they don't experience any significant downtime that would impact the business. There's a cost associated with that. And without scaring them, but yet putting a little fear into them, painting a picture of what it would be like without this type of support. It's an art. It's not easy to do. But once you absolutely get into a flow of communicating that, you're going to be able to sell it. And it's really selling them that you're needed to be there on a regular basis and you want to prioritize their support issues. An example, a retainer client will get a faster response than a non-retainer client. And I'm very specific with my clients. I just closed two clients and added them as retainers this past week. One of them was because in one of the pre-shows I described last week, actually before the Crypto Locker show, if you were in the chat, I described my day, which was saving a client's email server, getting it up and running, and their inbound email was now working. They were down and they had no support and they were not a retainer client. And I made the time. I went over, I helped them, I solved the problem. I was there 3.5 hours and everything was solved. Well, a couple days later, because when I left that day, They said, Mike, please send us a recommendation what you would think we need for support contract. Well, guess what I picked up yesterday? A signed contract and a check for support. I am now monitoring every weekend the server and the event logs because they know they can't experience that again. Now, there's no end-all guarantee that they're never going to have a hardware problem, and you certainly can't prevent everything, but there are things you can do by monitoring the space, making sure it's not going to run out, making sure the performance, making sure if there's some errors starting to creep in the event log, you address them quickly so they don't fester and become a serious problem and take down the server. These are important things for server maintenance. And you know what? They care about the workstations, but that's not in the contract. They care about the server, and that's how we're starting. And you know what? It's a beginning. It's only a couple hours a month, but that's okay. It's going to grow because they're going to want those regular quarterly cleanups. And I know that this contract will morph into more hours as they see the benefit of my services. And once they start tasting that, it's going to be worth it, and it's going to be cost effective. So you have to demonstrate, and you have to show them, and you have to paint that picture. This is from Dr. Glenn. Hi, Mike. I find myself using the Amazon app on my smartphone or tablet apps. How can we use your affiliate link with these apps so you can get credit? Keep up the good work. I don't know. That is a great question. And he's referencing my Amazon.MikeNation.net, which is my Amazon link. How do we get people with smartphones and those apps to do that? I don't know. If anybody out there is an affiliate for Amazon or you know how to make that happen, that's great. All I can recommend is on your smartphone or on your app, go to Amazon.MikeNation.net. And that would still work by giving me credit. And if you do that, of course, on your regular computer, that helps support the show. I get a commission. Your price is the same. Dr. Glenn, thank you very much for bringing that up, and we'll see if we can find a solution for that. Hey, Mike, I know it has been about a year, but I just wanted to thank you for your insight and help, not only regarding the question I had, but also for everything I learned from listening to your podcast. Anyway, the company I work for is looking to standardize on a backup solution, and I know you recommend StorageCraft. Most of our clients have between 1 and 5 servers or between 1 and 50 workstations. Do you think StorageCraft would be a good fit? I do. We do have a few larger clients with more than 10 servers and a couple hundred workstations as well. I noticed that the main server product was about $1,000. They will greatly discount. Well, maybe not greatly, but they will discount StorageCraft if you're going to be buying in bulk for a lot of servers. So you can buy them in packages and it won't cost, you know, $1,000 per server. So you can save a lot of money. And it seems very steep, and that might be hard sell for small clients. Not if you buy them in packs of 3 or 5. You could actually, that's a nice discount for the clients. But what really matters is the quality and performance of the software. That's right. Have you used the cloud features of the product or ever spun up a backup virtual machine, either local or in the cloud? Thanks again. I have not, but Winston Wolf always uses a recovery to a virtual machine from a StorageCraft backup, from a Shadow Protect backup. He does that all the time. Also, StorageCraft has a great product for backing up virtual machines. So you want to take a look at that. And remember, when you buy in bulk, you're going to get a great discount. Call them direct and discuss it. Become a reseller and save money that way too. It's too good of a product, and sometimes good things cost money. Sometimes you get what you pay for. When it comes to backups, how can you put a price on it? Of course, there is some price, You got to do it, and you got to do what's right, and you got to have great backups. I'm not moving off my position on StorageCraft and Shadow Protect. Andres, quick question about HP server monitoring software. Hello, Mike. Hope everything is well. You've mentioned HP server hardware monitoring in the past, and that's just the suite, used to be called Compact Insight Manager. I think it's HP Insight Control, and it's the systems management software for HP. And this comes with every HP server, the software. So you can download it from HP based on the model that you have for the drivers, install it, and just configure that for telling you for watching disk utilization, network utilization, memory utilization, any kind of performance and issues. This is your go-to software management tool for your hardware. Dell has the same set of software for their servers. When it comes to servers, I will only use HP or Dell. And I got to admit, lately it's been Dell because of the price. And I love HP. I grew up on HP servers. But the Dell servers have been very, very good. And I'll tell you, the last three servers I bought have been Dell, and they've been working out fine. This is a combo fix question, and he's desperate to know the answer. This is from Harry. First of all, I love your show and appreciate all your hard work. My question is about combo fix. I have looked everywhere but cannot find the answer that I am looking for. I am 16 and doing a computer repair course at college. When I asked my tutor, she said she's not heard of combo fix. I'm not surprised. There's a lot of people that haven't. I am forever seeing forums such as Bleeping Computers suggesting that you should not run combo fix unless advised by a trained helper, as it could cause damage to your computer. I have to say that I have ran it many times and have never experienced a problem. My question is, are people making a fuss about nothing when it comes to using combo fix, and when would it be the correct time to use it? Remember my advice. You don't just whip out combo fix and start running it. You only run it when you suspect there's an infection or it's been proven there's an infection. Combo fix could delete a critical system utility, and then that could cause a problem with booting. Keep that in mind. Have I ever had combo fix ruin a computer? No. It's only helped me. It's everybody just being cautious. And you want to be cautious anytime you're running such a utility like that, that, yeah, things could be, there could be an issue. That's why if you notice when combo fix starts out, it backs up the registry. If it's on XP, it makes sure that the recovery console's installed. Very important that these things are in place before it starts continuing and maybe replacing critical system files. This is from Pete, and it's about email notification. And Pete asked a very important question. He wondered, I always talk about getting alerts. Well, how am I doing that? Am I scheduling those alerts about the backups? And I wrote back to Pete, and I explained, the Shadow Protect software by default has a customizable agent that you can fill in the information for sending an email on certain conditions. And I always check to send me an email on a successful backup or a failed backup. It's very important that I get notified. And if I don't see an email, well, the absence of an email means there's something wrong. Maybe their internet went down and they couldn't send an email. Maybe there's some kind of other problem. So I don't schedule these things. It's built within the software and it takes care of it. That's how I get those alerts. I caught up on most of the email. I just have a couple that I'm going to get to that require a more long-winded answer. I have an email here that I'm saving that asked me, how do I buy a server? What are the recommendations? That's such a question. So I have a few of them that are just so all-encompassing that it's going to take me a long time to give it the proper answer that it deserves. So I'm holding off on them. I will get to those email questions. I know there's a couple of voicemails in the queue that I haven't had a chance to download. I'll also include them on the next show. I want to thank everybody for downloading and staying subscribed and giving me the attention. And your time is so precious. And giving me that sliver of time by allowing me to come into your life and share this information, I really, truly appreciate that. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening and for supporting the show, supporting my sponsors, my affiliates, and of course, using my Amazon link. It's getting close to Christmas. So the holiday season, and you know what makes a great gift? An Amazon gift card. And it's a gift that keeps on giving because you can use my link, amazon.mikenation.net. Buy an Amazon gift card, give it to someone with my link, and we can double dip. I get a commission on the gift card, and then that person can use that gift card and use my link, and I get a commission again. So that's the perfect gift. So I want to thank everybody for listening, and I'll be back next week. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.